We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus on WILL AM 580, Illinois Public Media. This is Carol Spindell sitting in for David Inge. At the controls today is Jason Croft, and our producer is Harriet Williamson. In this hour, we're going to be talking about Paris to the Past, Traveling Through French History by Train, by Ina Caro, published by W.W. Norton & Company. Our guest, Ina Caro, has a passion for visiting the historic monuments of France, and in this historical guidebook, she shares with us her observant eye and inexhaustible fund of stories. With her as our guide, we start in the 12th century and travel across 700 years of French history. The whole journey takes place on a series of subway and train trips from Paris, and each can be made in a day. So if you're listening and would like to join our conversation about travel in France and French history, of course, we'd be delighted. Our phone numbers are 217-333-9455. If you're further away, 1-800-222-9455. Or you can email us your question at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Ina Caro, welcome to Focus.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. On the one hand, it's wonderful that the French have conscientiously preserved their historic monuments because we can actually go and visit these places in the flesh and touch these stones. But it can make things confusing for a traveler to France who's trying to understand their history because you see a building from the 17th century and it's next to one from the 19th and it's next to a 14th century fortress. And it becomes a historical collage that can be hard for us to sort out. So you had the brilliant idea to make things simpler by visiting these monuments in chronological order. Now, obviously, this takes a bit of planning. But with your book in hand, a traveler who loves history could move through the centuries in a logical way, building on their understanding, and they could do it just by taking the metro and the trains from Paris. So we're going to talk about that today and how someone going to Paris could do that. It sounds like your book enterprise started serendipitously when you got off the metro at the wrong station. What happened?
We thought we were going to the racetracks, and we had gone to Longchamp, my husband and I, had gone to Longchamp the week before, and we had had such a good time that we wanted to go to the races again. And we heard that they were having races at Vincennes. And so we took the metro to Vincennes, and we got out, and we suddenly saw something that looked suspiciously like an enceinte, the outer wall of a castle. And indeed it was. There was a castle there with a moat, towers, and a perfect 14th century castle, and it was only 13 minutes from central Paris by metro. And it gave me the idea that we could take trips, the same kind of trip, to other places in France, take the train to other places in France and visit history. And I have arranged the trips through France chronologically. And that changed our experience totally. In fact, you can't imagine what a difference it makes. You can actually see architecture evolve as you travel from one place to another. You can watch huge military towers of an early fortress like Vincennes become fanciful turrets as feudal France, insecure in the Middle Ages, becomes the France of the Renaissance, becomes a nation state. You can see the no man's land that once surrounded these fortresses, and as you travel through time, you can see them evolve into gardens. You can see the changes in windows, in the feudal castles, you see narrow arrow-slit windows, and as you travel through time, they open up into huge pane windows, so the gardens that were once no man's land can be seen from inside, and they look like tapestries, and you see moats that once surrounded the feudal fortresses become reflecting pools.
Well, around the circumference of Paris, the whole historical travel enterprise is made possible because Paris has, around its circumference, these luxurious, beautiful, wonderful old train stations. So the whole thing stands, the foundation of it, is the wonderful railroad system in France. Maybe you could tell us a bit about how this rail system came to be.
Well, I don't know exactly how it came to be, but you have in Paris, you have everybody that's lived in Paris is familiar with how wonderful the metro is and how the metro can take you to every place within Paris. And at the metro stations, they have RER stations, which take you, which were built for, to take the Parisians that are working in Paris to their suburbs, to their homes in the suburbs. And the suburbs contain places like Versailles. And then you have train stations throughout Paris, beautiful train stations, which will take you to further afield. And as my books plays, you can travel through 800 years of French history by taking 25 train trips from Paris. You can, and I have arranged it chronologically so that you travel century by century.
Well, the first journey that you take us back in time on, maybe we should start off with the first one, is to the Basilica of Saint-Denis. Now, the Basilica of Saint-Denis is one of the most important monuments in French history, and yet Americans I talk to who have visited Paris rarely seem to have gone there. It's kind of under the radar, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, it's at one time it was in a very bad it was considered to be in a very bad neighborhood. But that's no longer the case. The neighborhood has been totally cleaned up. And Saint-Denis itself is a fantastic place. It's the first cathedral, Gothic cathedral, ever built. It's a place where it's the first time you have stained glass windows. Before that, you had the Romanesque churches, which were little round windows. And the Abbot Suger, who built Saint-Denis, just loved beautiful things, and he loved stained glass, so he wanted to have these huge stained glass windows. I don't know if you want me to tell you why
Let's talk a little bit about the Abbot Suger. He's certainly one of the more remarkable historic figures in this book. He was born a peasant, was he not? And yet somehow, against all odds, became a very powerful abbot.
He did. He became. He went to school with the King of France, Louis the Fat, and became friends with him. And it was through his friendship that he was able to project the image that the king would allow him to become an abbot of the Basilica of Saint-Denis. Actually, that was not the case. Louis the Fat, when he heard that he had been made the abbot, there was quite angry because nominating people for the abbot was a was something that gave the king a lot of power. But Suger became the abbot of Saint-Denis. And he transformed the place from a small Romanesque church into a Gothic cathedral.
He started out at the abbey as a servant boy, did he not? He was given to the Benedictine monks as a servant boy by his family. Somehow he was literate. He was lonely. And he would spend hours in the archive. I thought this was fascinating. He would look for deeds to land.
Right, and he expanded the holdings of Saint-Denis so that he found the deeds that had been lost in time, and expanded the territorial holdings of the Abbey of Saint-Denis, which we don't think of churches and abbeys as landholders today, but they were then.
Well, and sometimes he didn't find the deeds, but he managed to get hold of the land anyway, wasn't
it? Well, he was very creative, shall we say, and he made them up. I mean, he forged them.
But it sounds like it was impossible not to like Suger. He was brilliant. He had this amazing memory. He charmed everybody he met. He was a talented storyteller. He was also very artistic, as you said. He just loved beautiful things. He wanted not only to worship God, but to worship God in the most beautiful church ever.
Yeah, and it was you had Saint Benedict at that time, the same time, who felt that you should have austerity, and Suger's whole attitude towards the church was so totally different. He wanted it beautiful, didn't want it austere. He wanted the stained glass. He wanted everything. He wanted jeweled reliquaries. I mean, he wanted everything to be beautiful in the worship of God.
Well, we take stained glass in churches so much for granted, but it was so interesting to read the story of the beginning, the first stained glass windows.
I mean, right. I mean, they were usually, stained glass was just used in reliquaries and as jewels. And Suger was the first person to think of opening up windows in a church and using stained glass in those windows.
I want to just take a second here to say that we're speaking with Ina Caro. Her book is called Paris to the Past, Traveling Through French History by Train, published by W.W. Norton. This is Carol Spindell sitting in for David Inge on Focus this morning. And if you'd like to join our conversation, please call us 217-333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Or send us an email at willtalk@illinois.edu. Okay, so back to Abbot Suger. Now, you can't have big stained glass windows if you've got sort of gangs of people going around rampaging and pillaging, and you need a fortress in that kind of an era with thick walls and watchtowers. So he had to change the whole political system to have his stained glass, didn't he?
He certainly did. He's called the father of the French monarchy and the father of the Gothic church because you couldn't have the Gothic cathedral without having a strong monarch. And he took Louis the Fat and made him a strong monarch. He was really quite an incredible man, incredible understanding of power in the 12th century.
Well, in addition to light from the stained glass windows, he wanted height. He was like the first proponent of high ceilings.
Well, he used the Gothic arch for the first time. Before that, you had the Romanesque arch, which really couldn't give you the height that you can get from the Gothic arch.
Well, I loved the story in your book when he asked the king's foresters or somebody like that who was in charge of the king's forest, said, I need these really tall trees to build this church. And they said, oh, we don't have any trees that tall. So what did Suger do?
Well, he got a group of men together, and he led them into the forest himself and picked out the trees that were tall enough to build, he wanted them for supports to build his Gothic cathedral as tall as he wanted it. And so he needed these very tall trees. And he led these men that were so skeptical into the forest himself and found the trees.
So nothing would stop him. He just would not be deterred with this vision that he had of this remarkable church.
No, he was an incredible man. I don't know who you would compare him with today.
The other thing that I was surprised to learn was that before Suger's time, we just think of monarchy and hereditary kingship as going together. But before Suger's time, the nobles elected the French king from among themselves.
Oh, that's right. It was his idea. I mean, that's the reason he's called the father of the French monarchy. From the time of Suger on, you have the king is a hereditary office rather than an elective office. And this was something the noblemen of France were quite perturbed at. because it was quite a loss of power for them.
Understandably. And he enshrined this idea of hereditary kingship in his stained glass windows that he had these artisans that he brought to Saint-Denis make, did he not?
Yes, he did.
And so can we see that if we go to Saint-Denis today?
I think you can. The windows at Saint-Denis are quite beautiful. They're the first stained glass windows in France. And was built in the 12th century.
Now, when it was dedicated, I suppose bishops and cardinals and people came from all over France to the dedication, and it seems that it made quite an impression on these other abbots and bishops, the church that Suger had built, and they wanted one like that. There began to be all sorts of accidents at their churches.
Oh, absolutely. The only person that was the powerful Bernard of Clairvaux he detested the what Suger had done. But everyone else felt that it was so beautiful that fires broke out and people were building new cathedrals throughout France, as you say.
Mm. And he also affected merchants and the growth of cities, did he not, Suger?
Yes, he did. You built the cathedrals right. The cathedrals were built right in the city, and the merchants and everyone contributed to them. I'm not exactly sure what you mean by.
Well, didn't he strengthen the power of the merchants to kind of balance up against the power of the nobles?
Or? Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry. He wanted to take away the power from the of the noblemen, and the only way to do this was to strengthen the middle class.
Mm-hmm. Now, he also wrote his autobiography, which you say was very unusual in this era, and so we're really only left with his version of the events he took part in. And he also designed himself into the front of the basilica. If we go there, we can see him, can we not?
Yes, you can. He's a little figure kneeling in one of the windows, and he's quite cute. But when you have the only story of someone's life is written by themselves, you have to assume that he gives more credit to himself than he really deserves. But we have no other source.
Okay, so we'll have to take his word for it. Then you take us to the very beautiful cathedral at Chartres. I think many more Americans do visit Chartres. It's an easy train trip from Paris. But why is it so important to go to Chartres if we want to understand Gothic architecture and what was happening in France at this time?
Well, Chartres is one of the most beautiful cathedrals, and it has probably the largest number of tourists come to Chartres, perhaps because its windows are. You have 27,000 square feet of stained glass at Chartres, and it's one of the most beautiful experiences that you can have sitting there. It's the reason that so many people come is because it's so beautiful. There's a total harmony of composition. It's as though a Chartres were built at the very moment in time when deep religious spirit of the age of faith was most profound. One of the reasons that it was built is that the sacred tunic that had been worn by Mary was given to Chartres, and this was made it a place where you could say medieval tourists. They were really medieval pilgrims would come to Chartres, and Chartres was able to become quite wealthy and able to build this in the 12th century, build this remarkable cathedral.
Well, if I do get an opportunity to go back to Chartres someday, I'm definitely going to take your suggestion to bring binoculars so that I can read, in quotes, the stained glass windows.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it was Victor Hugo who said when he was writing Notre Dame, in the Middle Ages, men had no great thought that they did not write down in stone or write or express in the windows of at places like Chartres. It's not only the windows, but you have beautiful statues throughout Chartres. You have the prophets and the kings, Suger suggested that there was a unity of kingship and priesthood, and this is all expressed at Chartres.
You point out in the book that as the monarchy becomes more powerful, if we walk around Chartres, the statues become more lifelike and less like columns, and that we can see this progression at Chartres.
You can. At first, you have these statues that feel like they're compressed into stone, and the artistic quality is not what is most sought after. But as you're walking around Chartres, art becomes more and more accepted, and the statues become more and more lifelike and more and more beautiful.
They start to reach out of the columns. They start to move, you say, and I hope I get the chance to look at them again through these new eyes because that sounds so wonderful.
Yeah, and you had the windows, going back to the windows, they express the daily life of the Middle Ages, and you can learn what daily life was like. That's because the medieval merchants and tradesmen were paid for the stained glass windows, and you can see a baker with his carrying. You can see these tradesmen frozen in time. A vintner pruning his vine, a baker carrying a basket of bread, a fishmonger holding a fish for a customer. And this is all in the windows at Chartres so that you can see the daily life in the 12th century, the 12th and 13th century.
Okay, so before we take our next excursion, we're going to take a brief break, and then we'll be right back with Ina Caro, the author of Paris to the Past, Traveling Through French History by Train. This is Carol Spindell, sitting in for David Inge on Focus, WILL, Illinois Public Media.
I'm on a lonely street, but nobody told my feet they're walking on air, 'cause somebody cares for me.
On the next Fresh Air, Nick Lowe joins us in the studio to perform songs from his new album, The Old Magic. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from The Music Shop, celebrating 50 years of service to music education. The Music Shop serves over 200 school music programs with band and orchestra instruments, a large sheet music department, and thousands of accessories at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign, or at themusicshop.com.
Welcome back to Focus. This is Carol Spindell. I'm sitting in for David Inge today on Illinois Public Media, and we're speaking with Ina Caro. She's the author of Paris to the Past, Traveling Through French History by Train. It's a book that you can take if you are lucky enough to be planning a vacation to Paris. Take it with you, and she shows you how you can travel chronologically through French history just by taking the metro, the regional trains, or even maybe the high-speed train from Paris to go somewhere else in a day and come back. So maybe we should take a TGV, a high-speed train, for our next excursion and go somewhere like Angers.
Oh, the trip to Angers is probably, it's a city in the Loire Valley, which we had always felt was too far to reach by when we were visiting the castles in the Loire Valley by car. The 3-hour train ride from Paris was also too long. But that was before the TJV. Now Angera can be reached by taking a TJV, which will get you there in 90 minutes. You get off the train, you walk a block, and you turn a corner, and there in front of you is a dinosaur of a castle, a sight like nothing that exists in this country. There are 17 huge towers of black and white stone, each 164 feet tall, each large enough to hold an entire garrison of men and their supplies and arms. For me, the castle became much more interesting when I learned why it was built and who built it. It was built by a woman. It was built by Blanche of Castile, whose husband had died after a reign of only 3 years. The widow was left with an 11-year-old son who had not been crowned. If you go back to this point in time, you understand that the feudal lords had been, they had just the transition from feudal power of the lords to a central power of a king had just started taking place, and the lords saw a chance to get back, to retake their power. And Blanche built this castle to show them that they could not.
Well, now, Blanche of Castile is a fascinating character. She seems to have been a genius at sort of like presentation and marketing. I was thinking she would have been like a, you know, one of these people who works on presidential campaigns or political campaigns if she were alive today, because her husband dies. She's got this child who's going to be crowned, but it's a very tenuous thing. They're very in a very precarious position, she and her son. And somehow, in only 21 days, she manages to take care of all these details, informing everyone by horseback and hold this coronation.
Right, and getting him to the coronation, which was not an easy task, and getting him crowned. I mean, she had this 11-year-old son who was uncrowned, and she is able, within this short period of time, it was built by Blanche. She built Angers, and she was left with an 11-year-old son who was not crowned, and the lords saw their chance to take back their power. And Blanche of Castile built Angers just to show them that they could not, that she was a woman. Even though she was a woman, she was not to be messed with.
And she fought them, literally led an army against them, didn't she, by fighting in the winter or something? She held them off?
Right. It was unheard of to attack in the winter, but she did. I mean, everybody always, at that point in time in the Middle Ages, wars or battles were always held in the spring when the weather was good. But she went and with her army and attacked in the winter and took everyone by surprise.
Well, they also tried, these nobles, to kidnap her son, the young king. Even after he was crowned, he was on a journey, and he had to take refuge. He was, what, 20-something miles from his castle, and Blanche figured out a way to save him by appealing to the towns where he was.
Right, and she raised the people of all the towns came out and stood by as he made his way from along the way, and the people of France protected him from the nobles.
And he returned safely.
Yes.
It's a remarkable story. He sounds like he was a deeply religious young man.
It's difficult to say.
Uh-huh.
I always wonder about religion. Because so many people are killed in the name of religion, which seems to be at odds with what religion is supposed to be.
That's true.
He was called Saint Louis, so he was considered a very religious person, and he did... He
built Sainte-Chapelle, did he not? Which is a church that many travelers to Paris do visit, right in the heart of Paris.
Sainte-Chapelle is a place that anyone should visit. That's coming to Paris.
And it was built not really as a chapel or a church as we think of it. It seems like you're saying, but as a reliquary, a place to house some very, very important relics.
Yes, it houses the crown of thorns and a segment of the true cross. So Sainte-Chapelle is built like an inverted reliquary to emphasize this fact that it has the segment of the true cross, the two most the holiest of all reliquaries. And the Sainte-Chapelle is covered with elaborate decorations. It has the 12 statues of the apostles, which stand between the windows and are carved so that they look like pillars holding up Sainte-Chapelle. And they were meant to be symbolic of the fact that the 12 apostles are the true pillars of the church.
Now, Blanche had a great deal to do with all this, too. She was always behind the scenes orchestrating, it seems like, and arranging. She wasn't going to let her son buy these relics until she was pretty sure they were actually, as best could be determined, the real thing.
Yes, she wanted to make sure. She wasn't going to do it until she was satisfied with their authenticity. And she traveled. She, her son, and the king's younger brother traveled to where they met two Dominican friars who had been entrusted with carrying the chest containing the crown of thorns from Venice. Blanche then ordered that the chest be opened at once, and inside was a silver box with the seals of the Doge of Venice and the barons of the Byzantine Empire. And she compared these seals to the ones attached to the letter of the patent previously sent to her to authenticate the relics that had been given to the two friars. And Blanche found them identical. After breaking open the seal, she found a gold box inside, a silver one. And inside that was the crown of thorns, or what was thought to be the crown worn by Christ at his passion. That's actually a circle of straw to which, by that time, only a few fragments were attached.
Now, she also carefully orchestrated the public ceremonies celebrating the arrival of the relics. She had her own particular, I guess, political reasons to want these relics in Paris.
Yes, absolutely. And she wondered, she felt like... she had a great sense of
like spin marketing or perception. I don't know, something like that.
And she wanted quite a bit of ceremony to greet the relics when they arrived in Paris, and. And she chose very carefully the people that were going to build the Sainte-Chapelle, which was going to house the Crown of Thorns. And she found someone who had just built a Rayonnat choir at Amiens, which was quite beautiful. And his name was Thomas de Cormont, who designed Sainte-Chapelle in Paris.
So, and if someone listening is going to Paris sometime soon, they certainly should read this part of the book about Blanche before visiting Sainte-Chapelle. It certainly will seem much more dramatic and much more interesting.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting was the way the windows were made so that the king would be sitting in a circle of light. It had been actually Suzet's intention when he created the first window at Saint-Denis that jeweled light should be shining on the figure of the king. And this was done at Chartres as well.
Now we're going to take a brief moment here to tell our listeners that I'm speaking with Ina Caro about her book, Paris to the Past, Traveling Through French History by Train. This is Carol Spindell. I'm sitting in for David Inge. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 217-333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. If you have a question about historical travel to France, you can email it to us at will-talk@illinois.edu. So maybe we should jump ahead here to the 17th century and talk about there's no longer a need for fortresses with deep moats now. The country is much more secure, and wealthy French aristocrats are now building chateaux.
In the Loire Valley. All through the Loire Valley, you have one castle after another, which was when I was in the Loire Valley that I got the idea of traveling through time, traveling chronologically, because we were staying in Blois, which was sort of centrally located, and you could travel between several centuries of French history by going from the castle at Chinon, which was made famous by Joan of Arc, and then traveling chronologically from castle to castle to the last castle built in the you can go from the 16th century at Blois, and then go to Fontainebleau, and then magical Vaux-le-Vicomte.
Well, let's talk about Vaux-le-Vicomte and Nicolas Fouquet, who built it, and the wonderful gardens that surround it. And you tell us that if we go there now, we won't have to spend 3 days to see the gardens. We could zip around them in golf carts.
Yes, I don't think that was the intention of the person who designed the gardens, but it is, I know my grandchildren, it really enjoyed doing that. and the gardens are just beautiful and filled with statues, and it's one of the most magical. The whole trip to Vaux-le-Vicomte is magical.
Nicolas Fouquet, who built it, sounds like quite an amazing character. He was very young, charming, brilliant, slim, dark, handsome, the protege of the powerful Cardinal Mazarin.
Yes, he was. Women found him irresistible. He built Vaux-le-Vicomte.
He was put in charge of the king's finances at a very young age, was he not?
He was, which...
very powerful position.
Absolutely. And when Louis XIV came to visit him at Vaux-le-Vicomte, he was wondering what happened to a lot of the finances of the realm.
And he was right, was he not? A lot of the finances of the realm had gone into Vaux-le-Vicomte.
And Louis XIV did was imprison Fouquet and hire all the people that had built Vaux-le-Vicomte to come and build Versailles.
Now, Fouquet knew that he was embezzling all this money. He knew that his days might be numbered. He built a fortress for himself as an escape route, didn't he, also?
Yes, on an island, but he was not able to. But Louis XIV outsmarted him and arrested him before he could get to his island.
But before he went down, Fouquet threw a great party, did he not?
Yes. And I think maybe... he shouldn't have invited the king to it.
The king was drinking his wine and eating his tidbits, he was also planning his host's downfall.
I mean, this party was equaled by only one or two celebrations in the whole entire history of France. The meals were served on solid gold plates. Men who liked to gamble found purses filled with gold when they awoke in the morning, while women were given perfumes. There were ballets, concert, and plays, and a play written by Molière for the occasion.
Speaking of Molière, we should say that Fouquet, a more sympathetic side of him, he wasn't always just buying gold plates and giving away gold coins. He supported a lot of artists and writers, did he not? He was a true patron of the arts.
Oh, absolutely. And he supported Molière when Molière was quite in need of being supported.
And also La Fontaine, you mentioned, who wrote the famous fables.
Right, and also a number of other artists. He brought together a team of relatively unknown men to transform this castle at Vaux-le-Vicomte into what it is today. And he filled the library with manuscripts that were rare. He put ancient Greek marbles in the castle.
But maybe one of his faux pas was about the clearing in front, the view from the balcony where the king was staying when the king came to visit.
Yeah, he did that overnight.
The king looked out and said one spot seemed a little bare. And what did Fouquet do overnight?
He just filled it. It was just transformed by the time the king awoke in the morning. And Louis XIV was furious that such money had been spent and that he had such money to spend.
Now, maybe that gave Louis XIV an idea, because a forest also plays a role in Fouquet's downfall. The king invites him to go hunting, does he not? Someone invites him to go on a hunting trip, and they take him off into the forest farther and farther away from his little fortress on the island that he needs to get to if he things start to fall apart.
He had this fortress on Belier.
Yeah, but once he had gone off on this trip away from the coast hunting, he wasn't able to get there. Was that not the case? And he was arrested.
I think it was Colbert who really plotted against him, and plotted with the queen to created his downfall. And Louis XIV was attending a party at Vaux-le-Vicomte. Colbert was in Paris making arrangements for Fouquet's arrest. And finally, I remember what you're talking. The king liked the view from the balcony of his apartment in Vaux, except for one large, rather barren clearing. And he mentioned this to Fouquet. And the next morning he awoke, and it was completely filled with full-grown trees.
And he thought the king would be pleased, but the king was not pleased.
You know, he was so infuriated he wanted to arrest Fouquet on the spot. But Louis's mother persuaded him that it would not be right to be a guest in somebody's house and arrest them. So he waited until he returned to Versailles.
Now, your book goes on to follow the life of Louis XIV, and even there's a long chapter about his later life, which is quite remarkable, about Madame de Maintenon.
Right. She's quite a character. I think prune-faced, stern, and it's really amazing, after all the beautiful women that Louis XIV had, for him to be married to Madame de Maintenon.
And she also built a castle, chateau, I don't know exactly which we would call it, but she built a place that was very secret and that we could visit.
I visited. It was a throwback, like Madame de Maintenon. It was not built in the style of the times, but built as a medieval fortress or a medieval castle with turrets and things, and it's quite out of, it's not what they were building at the time of Louis XIV, but she was a throwback, and so was her castle.
And her castle had a very secret purpose, did it not? The castle was intended to hide the illegitimate children of Louis XIV.
Right. She had been, every time Louis XIV had an illegitimate child by Athenais, most of them by Athenais, she would whisk them away to Maintenon and hide them there.
And bring them up,
yes.
Did she not? And Louis XIV would come there and visit his children.
And he found her so wonderful with the children that he fell in love with her.
That's remarkable.
Or fell in love with the way way she took care of the children. I mean, he was most enamored by that.
Yeah. And before that, she had had a salon. She had been friends with writers and artists in Paris, had she not?
Absolutely. But this was quite a change for her.
Yeah. And he did. But did he make the marriage public? I mean, so much of their story was secret, was it not, at the time?
Well, it wasn't a marriage like he had had. It was sort of, how would I put it? It wasn't a marriage where king marries and she becomes queen. Madame de Maintenon never became queen.
Uh-huh. She was a commoner.
What is the word? Morganat? Well, I can't pronounce it. Type of marriage where the king marries someone, but the person does not get the trappings of the queen or any of the office that his former wives had had.
Okay, and so Maintenon, another of the places that we could visit by train. At the end of the book, you take us to a number of places around Paris and help us understand the history of these places, places that people could go easily on the metro or even on foot.
The Place de la Concorde, the Palais Royal, the Conciergerie, the Hotel Carnavalet, and the Pantheon, and the archives, which were, well, I guess the Palais Royal is one of the most interesting places that you could visit.
And tell us about that. Why? What should we think about when we walk into that wonderful rectangle?
It's a perfect place to begin a visit to the 18th century because it's located directly across from the Louvre, and its owner of the Palais Royal could see the Palace of the Louvre where the king was and could plot different, which he did. He would plot, the Duc d'Orléans would plot different ways to get rid of the king so that he could succeed him, and none of them ever succeeded.
Now, you say that he was the one who actually gave out the idea that Marie Antoinette had said, let them eat bread.
Right. He was... he did something else with Marie Antoinette. I mean, he really, well, in the first place, he was a notorious for his debauchery and his candlelit parties that he had, and he created, and the Palais Royal was like his private domain, Marie, when you say that she had heard that the peasants were starving, she said, let them eat cake if they could not afford bread.
Right.
Although that statement had been made by a queen of France, it was not Marie Antoinette, but Louis XIV's queen who actually said that.
Uh-huh. But the Duc d'Orléans thought it would be useful for people to think that Marie Antoinette had said that, let them
with
eat cake.
Marie-Thérèse.
Uh-huh. Well, you obviously greatly admire the relationship that the French have with their past. They've put a great deal of effort into preserving their past, keeping these monuments and retaining their history so that we can actually visit them. Do you think that we, as Americans who have such a different relationship with our own past, can we learn something from that, or was it just simply too different?
I think we're very, very different. We replace and they restore. They have such a we have such a short history compared to the French, and they really. I think it's also the tourism in France is quite. People go to France to see these sites and spend quite a bit of money, and I think that plays a great deal in as well as their love of their past and their pride in their past, also the love of having tourists come to see it. Whereas in the United States, I don't think we have very much regard for our past or regard for history in general.
So you seem to be saying that if you want to experience that, a deep regard for the past and a place where One visits the past in order to understand it. The thing to do, if you possibly can, is go to France.
Oh, absolutely. And even in some of the, every place that you go has a marvelous restaurant, so that visiting the past becomes an extremely delightful experience.
Visiting the past and enjoying the present at the same time.
Let us hope that they never change.
Well, I always admire the fact that I go back and some building that used to be sooty and grimy and dirty has been all cleaned and is gleaming and beautiful.
Oh, especially in Paris. I was just looking at some of the pictures that I had had of Paris 20 and 30 years ago, and they clean up all their buildings, and it's just so beautiful to the last trip we took to Paris was just so overwhelming because everything had been cleaned up.
Well, with that, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it and move on. This is Carol Spindell, and you've been listening to Ina Caro, who's the author of the book Paris to the Past, Traveling Through French History by Train, published by W.W. Norton. Ina, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me here. It was a delight.
Thank you. All right. And again, this is Carol Spindell sitting in for David Inge, Focus on Illinois Public Media.
Quite a bit of money. And I think that plays a great deal in as well as their love of their past and their pride in their past, also the love of having tourists come to see it. Whereas in the United States, I don't think we have very much regard for our past or regard for history in general.
So you seem to be saying that if you want to experience that, a deep regard for the past and a place where one visits the past in order to understand it, the thing to do, if you possibly can, is go to France.
Oh, absolutely. And even in some of the, every place that you go has a marvelous restaurant, so that visiting the past becomes an extremely delightful experience.
Visiting the past and enjoying the present at the same time.
Let us hope that they never change.
Well, I always admire the fact that I go back and some building that used to be sooty and grimy and dirty has been all cleaned and is gleaming and beautiful.
Oh, especially in Paris. I was just looking at some of the pictures that I had had of Paris 20 and 30 years ago, and they clean up all their buildings, and it's just so beautiful to the last trip we took to Paris was just so overwhelming because everything had been cleaned up.
Well, with that, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it and move on. This is Carol Spindell, and you've been listening to Ina Caro, who's the author of the book Paris to the Past, Traveling Through French History by Train, published by W.W. Norton. Ina, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me here. It was a delight.
Thank you. All right. And again, this is Carol Spindell sitting in for David Inge, Focus on Illinois Public Media.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
And good morning. I'm Jeff Bossert, your host for the Afternoon Magazine. Today, sitting in for Celeste Quinn. We'll take a now look at the markets at 2 minutes before 12. In Kansas City, hard red winter wheat at 781.5, down 10.5. And the December wheat in Minnesota, 691, down 13.5. December corn in Chicago, 704, down 20.25. March, 717.75, down 20.25. May, 725.25, down 20.25. Crude oil, October, 89.56, that's up 64. November, soybeans, 1361.75, down 21. January, at 1372.75, down 21. March, 1380, that's down 20.75. October soybean meal, 31.50, down 7.30. October soybean oil, 56.33, that's down 45. October live cattle, 119.60, that's a down $1.40 October feeder cattle, 138.40, down 55. October lean hogs, 89.15, that's up 70. December, 84.55, also up 70. In the outside markets, October crude oil, 89.65, up 74. October natural gas, 390, that's up, that's down 13. And RBOB gasoline, 278, down, or rather up 61. At this hour, the Dow is at 11,387. That's up 140. And U.S. dollar 76.30, down 52 cents. And the S&P 1202.80. That's up 14. In the forecast for the Champaign-Urbana area today, we're having sunny skies, cool air prevailing across central and southeast Illinois. Low temperatures were 15 to 20 degrees below normal, ranging from 37.